Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Alice Bryant, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
Recently, Ale Hoke walked among a group of trees that she helped plant last year in the Brazilian city of Rio de Janeiro. The small piece of land is near Providencia. It is Rio de Janeiro's first poor neighborhood, known in Brazil as a favela. There, homes lie close to one another. Bullet holes suggest the presence of violence. The green area is a kind of garden. It is one of many places where trees are making the city of Rio greener. This is cacao, developing well. Look at this lime tree. It's full. Lots and lots of tomato, Hoke said. As she walked, she saw a yam and reminded herself to pick it with the children that she teaches to garden. In addition to providing free food to residents, the small piece of land provides something else. It is cooler in the shade, something rare in this part of the city, far from the sea breeze of Copacabana and Ipanema. The activist group Catalytic Communities has mapped sustainable projects across Rio de Janeiro. Teresa Williamson, the group's executive director, said there are more and more new green projects. There seems to be now, all of a sudden, in the last 6 months even, a growth in interest, she said. Rio is famous for its coastal forests. But Rio's dense neighborhoods have little plant life. Around 80 neighborhoods have less than 1% tree cover. Most are in the industrial north zone. Without shade, these so-called heat islands make summer even hotter. This month, the city's highest temperatures reached around 40 degrees Celsius. People in Rio also talk about the apparent temperature, a measure that includes wind and humidity. That number reached as high as 54.8 degrees Celsius on January 11th. Washington Fajadu is a visiting housing policy researcher with Harvard University. He said green projects represent a break with Rio's recent past. Fajadu also is the former mayor's special advisor on urban issues. He told Associated Press reporters, "To get a tree to grow in an urban environment requires irrigation, because pollution makes it much harder for a sapling to reach adulthood. We knew how to do that better at the start of the 20th century than we do today, strangely." I'm John Russell.
The Hudjin, are one of China's smallest ethnic minority groups. Early Hanzhen people developed methods for making clothes, bedding, and thread out of fish skin. For that reason, they became known in China as the fish skin tribe. But today, the tradition is dying. Yo Wenfeng is one of the few people in her community carrying on the tradition. She was not yet born when her people were sent to labor camps during Japan's occupation of Manchuria in the 1930s and 1940s. Yo, who is 68, told Reuters reporters that many Hanzhen died in the camps. But her mother survived, and she taught her daughter about fish skin. The Hanzhen are native to Siberia. Traditionally, they were hunters and fishers, making their living along rivers. After World War II, the Hanzhen population grew from 300 to 5,000 along the Amur River, also known as the Black Dragon River. But that population growth did not stop the loss of Hanzhen culture, including making clothing from the skin of fish like carp, pike, and salmon. Few young Hanzhen wanted to learn the skill. Fish skin clothing is also not what Hanzhen people wear today. Knowing this, Yo started to share her knowledge with local Han Chinese women in Tongjiang, where she lives. The quiet city sits near China's northeastern border with Russia. Yo's followers also learn the Yumakan, a kind of storytelling that uses both speech and song in the Hanzhen language. The lessons are not easy. Yo's followers memorize songs of fishing, hunting, and ancient tribal victories in a language they do not speak. During a visit by Reuters reporters, Yo began to sing in her small apartment. She sang of a woman's wish to have a son for her hunter husband. Hanzhen hunters rowed on narrow boats made from birch wood. Yo described the boats as swift horses. The Hanzhen were so skillful on water that their ancient stories say they came from mermaids. When the forests flooded to the treetops, there would be fish everywhere, Yo said. These days, fish are bought from the marketplace. And instead of tiger bone and the tissue of deer, a special sewing tool and cotton thread are used. A piece of clothing for a woman requires 50 fish. For a man, it requires 56, Yo said. I'm Alice Bryant.
A Vietnamese company says it has been developing its own equipment to launch 5G mobile services nationwide. But some experts question whether the country has the ability to develop what it is claiming. The company, Vitel Group, announced earlier this month it is aiming to launch 5G services beginning in June. 5G is the next generation in wireless technology. The announcement came after Vitel, which is run by Vietnam's military, demonstrated a test video call carried over its 5G network. Top officials from the government and Vitel attended the demonstration event in Hanoi. The officials said the equipment and software used to make the 5G call was developed by Viettel over a six-month period. The company says it plans to develop both civilian and military services based on its own 5G equipment and network. Viettel declared that with its technology development, it had become the sixth company in the world to produce 5G network equipment. The other companies working on the technology include Huawei, Nokia, Ericsson, Samsung, and ZTE. China-based Huawei is the world's largest telecommunications equipment supplier, capturing nearly 30% of the market. The company is a leader in 5G mobile networks and a top producer of smartphones. Huawei is currently working on building 5G systems in countries around the world. But in the United States, officials have urged American companies not to use Chinese technology, including Huawei equipment, in communications systems. The officials have expressed concerns about Huawei's links to the Chinese government, saying the company's network equipment could be used to help carry out spying activities. Huawei has rejected such accusations. The U.S. administration also placed a ban on American companies sharing technology with Huawei because of security concerns. It has also pressed other countries to ban Huawei from building 5G networks. Viettel's chief executive officer, Lei Dongzhong, told Bloomberg last August that the company had no plans to work with Huawei. "There were reports that it's not safe to use Huawei," Zhong said at the time. "So Viettel's stance is that, given all this information, we should just go with the safer ones, so we choose Nokia and Ericsson from Europe." Viettel did not name Nokia and Ericsson as partners during its demonstration of the new 5G equipment. Dimitris Mavrakis is the research director for ABI Research and an expert on the worldwide telecommunications industry. He told VOA he is doubtful about Vietnam's new claims. "I would say that a home-developed 5G infrastructure is impossible, not only improbable, but impossible, because it is very difficult," Mavrakis said. "If such a process was so easy," he noted, "major American companies like AT&T and Verizon would have done it as well." Mavrakis said among the biggest problems Vietnam would face creating such a system would be huge research and development efforts and costly patents covering 5G technology. He added that Viettel most likely does not have any patents for intellectual property rights relating to the technology. And, in fact, Viettel doesn't have a big enough research and development workforce in order to create this technology, Mavrakis said. Even Huawei and Ericsson and Nokia had to spend billions to create this technology, he added. Murray Hebert is a senior associate with the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. He told VOA he is not surprised that Vietnam would be unwilling to cooperate with Huawei on its 5G development. "This is because Vietnam has long felt pressure from China in a number of areas, particularly over issues involving the disputed South China Sea. Therefore, Vietnam is very, very sensitive to letting Chinese technology be used for developing 5G in Vietnam, particularly Huawei," Hebert said. However, he said he is not sure what to think about Vietnam's announced plans for homegrown 5G.
I guess I'm a little surprised that they're declaring they've reached this goal when others are still striving for that goal, who have been working at it a lot longer and have more experience.
Hebert noted that Viettel has already expanded its telecommunications services to other Asian neighbors and beyond, and may want to try to do this with 5G technology as well. But whether that is realistic or not, I don't know, he noted. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The first 10 years of the 20th century in America were shaped by the strong leadership of President Theodore Roosevelt. And in the second decade, he returned to national politics to bring once more dramatic changes to the United States. Theodore Roosevelt was a distant cousin of Franklin Roosevelt, a Democrat who became president in 1933. In 1912, Teddy Roosevelt organized a new political party, the Progressives. Roosevelt created this new party after he failed to win the Republican presidential nomination. The Republican Convention of 1912 had been controlled by conservative supporters of President William Howard Taft. And, as we hear now from Leo Scully and Morris Joyce, the party nominated Taft for four more years in the White House.
As a result, Roosevelt broke with the Republicans, and he and his supporters held their own convention. They formed the Progressive Party and approved a platform that promised reforms. These reforms were proposed to make the government serve the people and carry out more fully their desire for social progress. The Democratic Party also nominated a candidate who supported progressive ideas. The Democrats chose Governor Woodrow Wilson of New Jersey, a former president of Princeton University. So, for the first time in many years, there were three major candidates for president. Wilson clearly had the best chance to win. He had the support of almost all the Democrats. The Republicans, however, were split. Some supported Taft, the others were for Roosevelt.
Roosevelt refused to accept the idea of defeat. He campaigned hard, visiting many cities and towns, making speech after speech. Wilson also campaigned hard. He seemed to enjoy it as much as Roosevelt. Taft did not like it at all. He refused to do much campaigning. He spent most of the time at his summer home. It was a quiet election campaign until the middle of October. Then, only 3 weeks before Election Day, Roosevelt was shot.
It happened in Milwaukee. Roosevelt had just left his hotel and climbed into the automobile that would carry him to the hall where he planned to make a speech. As he stood in the open car, an extremist named John Schrank ran up to him, pulled a gun from his coat, and fired a bullet into Roosevelt's chest. The bullet knocked him down. Roosevelt said it felt as if he had been kicked by a mule. jumped up and put his hand to the wound. The bullet had passed through the inside pocket of his coat. It struck a steel case that held his glasses and went through the folded 50 pages of his written speech. These slowed the bullet, and it went only a few centimeters into his chest.
Roosevelt did not know if he was seriously wounded. He put his hand to his mouth and coughed. No blood came, and he knew the shot had not damaged his lungs. Roosevelt ordered the crowd around to stop beating Schrank. "Bring him to me," he said. He looked down at the man. "You poor creature," said Roosevelt. Then he turned away. Doctors arrived. They said Roosevelt must go at once to the hospital. But Roosevelt refused. He said he would go to the hall. "I will make this speech," he said, "or die. It will be one or the other." On his way to the hall, he told a friend, "It takes more than that to kill a Roosevelt. I do not care a rap about being shot, not a rap."
At the hall, he stood before the big crowd. His face was white, but he stood straight without help. Someone announced that Roosevelt had been wounded, but still planned to speak. Roosevelt's voice was very low, almost a whisper. "I am going to ask you to be very quiet, and please excuse me from making a long speech. I'll do the best I can, but there is a bullet in me." He paused and then continued. "It is nothing. I am not hurt badly. I have something to say, and I will say it, as long as there is life in my body."
Roosevelt's speech was not important. He said nothing that he had not already said many times before. What was important, however, was his cool courage. Men did not see his act as foolish or overly dramatic. They saw it as the brave act of a strong man. To the public, he was a hero. Roosevelt spoke for almost an hour. Finally, very weak, he let himself be helped from the hall. He was rushed to a hospital where doctors could examine the wound.
The doctors found that the bullet had broken a rib, but caused no serious damage. They decided to leave the bullet where it was. The next day, Roosevelt made a statement from his hospital bed. "Tell the people not to worry about me, for if I go down, another will take my place." President Taft and Woodrow Wilson sent messages of regret to Roosevelt. They announced that they would not campaign until Roosevelt was able to do so.
Roosevelt's condition improved quickly. After 2 weeks of rest, he was ready to continue his campaign for the presidency. He made a speech to a big crowd at Madison Square Garden in New York City. Everyone was surprised to see how strong and healthy he seemed. Wilson ended his campaign in New York City the next day. He told a cheering crowd of Democrats, "What the Democratic Party proposes to do is to go into power and do the things that the Republican Party has been talking about for 16 years.
On November 5th, the people voted. The winner was Woodrow Wilson. He received more than 6 million votes. Roosevelt was second with 4 million. Taft received only about 3.5 million. Wilson's victory was even greater in the electoral vote. He got 435. Roosevelt got only 88. And Taft received only the 8 electoral votes of Utah and Vermont. The Democrats won not only the White House, but also control of Congress. And a number of Democratic governors were elected in states formerly controlled by Republicans.
The 1912 campaign ended public life for Theodore Roosevelt. Soon after the election, a friend visited Roosevelt and talked of possible victory in 1916. "I thought you were a better politician," Roosevelt said. "The fight is over. We are beaten. There is only one thing to do. That is to go back to the Republican Party. You cannot hold a party like the Progressive Party together. There are no loaves and fishes, no financial support."
War was soon to break out in Europe. The United States would enter the struggle in 1917. As always, Roosevelt was ready to join in a fight. He asked for permission to organize an American force and lead it into battle in France. President Wilson, however, turned down the request. Roosevelt was sure that it was a political decision. He never forgave Wilson for keeping him out of the war. Although Roosevelt himself could not fight, 4 of his sons went into battle. One, his youngest son, Quentin, did not return. And when he received news of his son's death, Roosevelt wrote these words to honor him:
"Only those are fit to live who do not fear to die. And none are fit to die who have shrunk from the joy of life. Both life and death are parts of the same great adventure. All of us who give service and stand ready for sacrifice are torchbearers. We run with the torches until we fall, satisfied if we can then pass them to the hands of other runners. The torches whose flame is brightest are carried by the brave men on the battlefield, and by the brave women whose husbands, lovers, sons, and brothers struggle there. These are the torchbearers. These are they who have dared the great adventure."
Roosevelt's own great adventure was itself coming to an end. He suffered from painful attacks of inflammatory rheumatism and from a serious ear infection. He had difficulty in hearing and could not walk. But the old man was still cheerful. He spent his 60th birthday in the hospital. And to his family and friends, he said, "I am ahead of the game. Nobody ever packed more kinds of fun and interest into 60 years. Death came to Roosevelt as he slept on the night of January 6th. 1919. Said Vice President Thomas Marshall, "Death had to take him sleeping, for if Roosevelt had been awake, there would have been a fight."
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.